To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.
And now for a few words from our president.
A free and secure and peaceful Iraq. A free and secure Iraq in the midst of the Middle East will have enormous historical impact.
Makes you proud, doesn't it? Or maybe makes you want to bang some pots and pans in Market Square on Tuesday. In this spot lately, we have been bringing you extreme news. News too true to be true. Unfortunately, today's extreme news is actually true. You may have noticed that Medicare Part D, the new prescription drug program, has not been working out very well so far since its implementation earlier this month. Well, we found this quote, actual quote, by President Bush at the Tampa Convention Center in Tampa, Florida, on February 4th, 2005, which may help us to understand the trouble we are now experiencing. Question from a woman in the audience. I don't really understand. How is it the new plan is going to fix the problem? Verbatim response by President Bush.
Because the all which is on the table begins to address the big cost drivers. For example, how benefits are calculated, for example, is on the table. Whether or not benefits rise based upon wage increases or price increases. There's a series of parts of the formula that are being considered, and when you couple that, those different cost drivers, affecting those, changing those with personal accounts, the idea is to get what has been promised more likely to be, or closer delivered to, that has been promised. Does that make any sense to you? It's kind of muddled. Look, there's a series of things that cause the, like, for example, benefits are calculated based upon the increase of wages as opposed to the increase of prices. Some have suggested that we calculate the benefits will rise based upon inflation, supposed to wage increases. There is a reform that would help solve the red if that were put into effect. In other words, how fast benefits grow, how fast the promised benefits grow, if that growth is affected, it will help on the red.
Yes, he did actually say that.
Bush said, vote for me in 2000. That's me. Put me and my pals in the White House for freedom and prosperity.
No, we don't want no more whoppers. We've had it up to here with the lies. Tell Bush and his mob to find another job serving their whoppers with fries.
Cut taxes for all the rich folks. A big dose to cure all our ills. We'll do it without cutting spending or sending your grandkids the bills. The rich folks will then help the poor folks. As many good jobs as you please. They'll hire American workers and not ship your job overseas.
No, we don't want no more whoppers. We've had it up to here with the lies. Tell Bush and his mom to find another job serving their whoppers with fries.
Saddam is in league with Al-Qaeda. He may have helped plan the attack. He's part of the axis of evil, the terrorist trained in Iraq. Saddam's building nuclear weapons. The CIA's got certain proof. No, we don't want no more whoppers. We've had it up to here with the lies. Tell Bush and his mob to find another job, serving their whoppers with fries. Iraqis will not mind our smart bombs. They'll welcome our troops to their soil. They'll ask us to stay there forever and help them get rich from their oil. We've put bad Iraqis in prison. Iraq will be helped by their laws. We're treating them just like we ought to. So don't you believe the Red Cross.
No, we don't want no more whoppers. We've had it up to here with the lies. Tell Bush and his mob to find another job, serving their whoppers with fries.
Wants to be re-elected. His campaign will play on our fears. They want us to swallow more whoppers and give them another 4 years. But America, we can do better. We don't have to take one more lie. We can go to the polls in November. Bush and Cheney goodbye.
Because we don't want no more whoppers. We've had it up to here with the lies. Tell Bush and his mom to find another job, serving their whoppers with fries.
That was No More Whoppers by Sun and Letter.
And now for another word from our president.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
Radio EcoShock News now brings us Gaia's Revenge, with a focus on global climate disruption. As we all know, this is another place where George W. Bush and his administration has fallen short of our hopes, and in fact surpasses all levels of expected disappointment.
Those lazy, hazy days of winter. Hi-ho, it's news from Radio EcoShock. You gotta love the solid-state doublespeak that passes for environmental reporting in China. You gotta. Otherwise, they'll shut you down and re-educate your sorry. While Beijing citizens are gasping for breath behind their surgical masks, this is how the government tells it through their wholly owned news service called Xinhua. The headline? Hazy days impede Beijing's blue sky goal. Yep, in China, even the sky is expected to meet government targets. But don't call it smog. That sooty guck is just mid-air suspending haze.
Those lazy, hazy, crazy.
The Beijing city government set a goal for 238 blue sky days this year, but the last 9 days in January were health chokers instead. Not that we can believe any of these statistics, but Xinhua claims that the capital had 64.1% blue sky days in 2005. Well, comrade, that means 4 days out of 10 delivered a killing smog. I mean, mid-air suspending haze. You can find the rosy interpretation of disastrous air quality at news.xinhua.com/English. Xinhua is spelled X-I-N-H-U-A. We get a more scientific explanation from livescience.com for January 20th. Quote, smog is blocking sunlight in China and making much of the country significantly darker than it was half a century ago. Using nearly 500 instruments spread throughout the country that record the amount of sunlight reaching the ground, researchers found that solar radiation has decreased by about 2% per decade since 1954. The country is roughly 10% darker on average than it was 50 years ago. Imagine, humans have actually made the sky go dark. And it isn't more clouds. In fact, researcher Yun Yan from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory reports cloud cover has decreased in China. So the change comes from fossil fuel emissions, which increased ninefold in the last century. That smoggy coal haze is absorbing and deflecting sunlight. You can find that study online in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. The Beijing government is trying to clear the air, especially if they want people to breathe during the 2010 Olympics. Beijing formed a new energy police in January to track down unnecessary lighting and wasted heat in shopping malls and office buildings. For the first time, there will be an enforcement team to back up the national slogans to reduce energy imports and pollution. They have a long way to go. According to the Asian Development Bank, Chinese industry uses 4 times more power to create a single unit of the gross domestic product compared to the top industrialized countries. The independent newspaper in Britain at www.independent.co.uk has become a leader in breaking environmental stories. On January 19th, their science editor Steve Connor reported something that should send chills up the spines of all creatures who have spines. As you may know, the whole chain of life depends on microscopic plants in the ocean called plankton. Now, scientists have found that global warming can starve plankton in the sea. Connor says this could have, quote, catastrophic implications for the entire marine habitat, end quote. The new study comes from a team led by Jeff Hoosman at the University of Amsterdam. They find that global warming is heating the ocean surface waters and interfering with the exchange of nutrients from the deep sea. Without nitrogen, phosphorus, and iron, the plankton weaken and die. It gets worse. We depend on the massive banks of plankton to capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and sink it into the sea. If we lose plankton, there could be a positive feedback mechanism resulting in ever more carbon dioxide in the Earth's air supply. It's a good time to hear from one of the early politicians brave enough to write about global warming. Former Vice President Al Gore is about to publish his newest book in April. The publisher is the longtime organic house Rodale Books. The title, An Inconvenient Truth. Yes, indeed. The book is a companion to a documentary film about Gore's climate campaigning recently shown at the Sundance Film Festival. That's also called An Inconvenient Truth. In both book and film, Gore argues there is indisputable proof that the climate is shifting and humans are causing it. According to the famous scientist James Lovelock, it's all too late anyway. In his February release called Gaia's Revenge, the aging Lovelock fears that humans have failed to react to their greatest crisis since their time began. Who is he? In the 1970s, this fellow of the Royal Society, Dr. James Lovelock, proposed the Gaia theory, that the Earth and its life form a complete living system. Living things have modified the Earth and its atmosphere to further the goals of life itself. Lovelock was no environmentalist. At the time, he was working for Shell Oil. He's been a huge fan of nuclear power and continues to advocate more reactors for everyone. In science, Lovelock's Gaia theory led to an important reconception of the operation of Earth. Many scientists have adopted it. The Greens and the public went further to imagine the Earth as a single living entity, perhaps a power worthy of religion. That was beyond Lovelock's scientific intent. Now, at age 86, Lovelock surveys the tsunami of scientific evidence for human-induced climate change and concludes that the carbon balance of the atmosphere has already been irrevocably changed. We can only hope to mitigate the damage, but not stop, huge, almost unimaginable changes for life on Earth. Without a complete U-turn of the carbon economy, Lovelock predicts that by 2100, the only place fit for human life will be in the Arctic. He writes, quote, "It was ill luck that we started polluting at a time when the sun was too hot for comfort. We have given Gaia a fever, and soon her condition will worsen to a state like a coma. She has been there before and recovered, but it took more than 100,000 years. Much of the tropical landmass will become scrub and desert. Before this century is over, billions of us will die, and the few breeding pairs that survive will be in the Arctic, where the climate remains tolerable." End quote. Strangely, Lovelock says that pollution itself has helped deflect some of the sun's heat in a phenomenon called global dimming. But, quote, "This global dimming is a transient and could disappear in a few days, like the smoke that it is, leaving us fully exposed to the heat of the global greenhouse. We are in a fool's climate, accidentally kept cool by smoke. We will do our best to survive, but sadly, I can't see the U.S. or the emerging economies of China and India cutting back in time, and they are the main source of emissions. The worst will happen, and survivors will have to adapt to a hell of a climate. So says James Lovelock. Get the full article in The Scotsman for January 17th at thescotsman.com. A host of scientists and public bureaucrats, including the UK Environment Minister, privately agree with Lovelock's despair about human failure to adapt to the carbon crisis. The Independent newspaper asked the well-known scientific author, Mark Lynas, to write a response. Lynas says, quote, "He's right, in my opinion, that this is the most likely scenario. But that doesn't mean we should give up the daily slog of trying to prove otherwise. Lovelock's grim warning shouldn't be a recipe for fatalism. True, carbon is now accumulating at the atmosphere at a record rate, 2.2 parts per million last year. But no one should be misled into thinking that as things stand, it's already too late. If all emissions stopped tomorrow, we'd almost certainly stabilize at less than 2 degrees, saving billions of lives and countless species from extinction. It's the fact that emissions aren't going to stop that is the problem, and it is here that we need to make sure that fatalism doesn't kick in." End quote from Mark Lynas. That's been the general reaction in various net forums like metafilter.com. One wag said he was canceling his order for a Toyota Prius hybrid, since it was too late anyway. Survivalists are wondering if their food in the bunker will be of any use. We already know there will be millions, perhaps even billions, of climate refugees. The imminent climate catastrophe breeds its own mental and cultural problems. How can we face it? Shall we give up? Or maybe we should start standing out in the streets with our symbolic red scarves or hats in our millions until the traffic stops, until the leaders are compelled to lead. Do you care if the earth goes to hell? Will you drive that gas guzzler to the edge of the cliff to watch it all? This has been news from Radio EcoShock, a full-time voice for the planet at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Listen to what's happening to your planet.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
Some labor history. We're frequently being warned about this or that alien menace, about foreigners or terrorists who might attack our shores. But the perceived threat does not always come from abroad. Throughout much of the 19th century and early 20th century, the business-owned press stoked an anti-radical hysteria among the general public by targeting what they called the dangerous classes within the United States itself. The dangerous classes were, specifically, the poor, the immigrants, the underemployed, and anyone who organized for a decent-paying job and better work conditions. Labor agitation was stigmatized as a threat to the American way of life. True Americanism was equated with an uncritical acceptance of the corporate business system. Industrialists joined with publishers in branding labor activists as communist, anarchist, and un-American. Posters and pictures were circulated showing Uncle Sam guiding American workers away from the swarthy agitators. The term un-American first came into significant usage at the turn of that century as a political epithet during this period when true Americans used it against striking immigrant workers and later against any militant opponents of the economic order, immigrant or native-born. In 1886, during a time of substantial labor unrest, Theodore Roosevelt, himself a rich employer, talked of setting worker against worker in the name of patriotism. Quote, I'm quoting Teddy Roosevelt now, "My men are hard-working, laboring men who work longer hours for no greater wages than most of the strikers, but they are Americans through and through. I believe nothing would give them greater pleasure than a chance with rifles at one of the mobs." So here we had Teddy Roosevelt almost inciting his own workers and glorifying and praising them for their supposed willingness to kill fellow workers. To dilute the labor militancy of its employees, the Ford Motor Company sponsored Americanization programs for them. Patriotism was equated with labor discipline and compliant worker attitudes. Other business firms fashioned programs modeled after Ford's. War often brings out the worst aspects of this pseudo-patriotism. In 1917, as the nation plunged into war with Germany, domestic labor disputes were treated as acts of outright disloyalty. President Woodrow Wilson warned that the masters of Germany were using American liberals, socialists, and the leaders of labor to carry out their wicked designs. That's a quote. Federal and state authorities suppressed radical publications, issued injunctions against strikes, harassed and jailed labor organizers, and launched legislative hearings, mass arrests, deportations, and political trials against labor militants. About 1,000 people were sentenced to prison for denouncing the war as a rich man's venture, some for as much as 30 years. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, corporations like Ford took matters into their own hands, hiring mobsters and company thugs to beat union organizers and terrorize strikers. Corporate-sponsored ultra-nationalist violence occurred in other capitalist countries as well. During the rise of fascism in Italy, Lithuania, Germany, Hungary, and Japan, so-called patriotic goon squads were hired by business owners to smash labor unions and leftist political parties and publications. In short, the ruling corporate class will use political crises, some of which it creates itself, to suppress working-class militancy and to direct our grievances toward innocent targets, toward working people, toward each other, toward immigrants, toward the poor, so that we do not rally and unite against those who are the real cause of our grievances. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
You're listening to Making Waves.
We won't be proven wrong. I believe that we will find the truth, and the truth is he was developing a program for weapons of mass destruction.
George W. Bush on Iraq. If these words from our president are making you angry enough to hit something, please bring your pot and your pan to Market Square Tuesday night, beginning at 8:30, for the protest of the State of the Union speech. And now for Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Baer, former CIA agent and author of the book See No Evil, who explains why he believes Washington politics and corporate influence have hurt the nation's fight against terrorism. Felice Yeskel, co-author of the book Economic Apartheid in America, who examines the reasons for growing income inequality in the U.S. And Wilma Subra, a MacArthur Award-winning environmental chemist, who discusses the health dangers of contaminated soil and air in New Orleans and the issues confronting the government and how to safely clean it up. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a new report, Amnesty International decries a growing epidemic of domestic violence that kills 14,000 women in Russia every year at the hands of their spouse or other family member. In contrast, 2 women die a week from physical abuse in Britain, and 1,200 American women die each year from domestic violence. Yet Russia does not have a criminal law on family violence, even though a draft of a law was debated in the 1990s in the Duma or Parliament. Moscow, a city of 10 million people, does not have a shelter for battered women, and 18 non-governmental organizations working on family violence cases in Russia closed due to a lack of government funding. According to the website oneworld.net, outside experts say the rising level of domestic violence in Russia is caused by a high rate of alcoholism, the post-Soviet economic decline, and the poor social standing of Russian women in politics and business. As Cynthia Klima of the Rocky Mountain Western Slavic Studies Association noted, the Russian economic problem is so frustrating that it has caused a lot of anger, and men are taking it out on their wives. 28-year-old Argentine engineer Edmundo De Ferrari has a dream to make soybean farmers energy self-sufficient. Backed by local seed company Don Mario, De Ferrari is trying to persuade small groups of farmers suffering from high oil prices to invest in soy biodiesel, A prototype plant, 145 miles west of Buenos Aires, can make 360 gallons of biodiesel and 10 tons of animal feed a day from 12 tons of soybeans. So far, biodiesel in South America is a niche commodity, but pressure is building in the Argentine parliament to mandate a mix of 5% biodiesel and regular diesel fuel. Neighboring Brazil has already adopted the biodiesel requirement and has built its first commercial biodiesel refinery. Brazil has also made a major investment in sugarcane-based ethanol, producing 4 billion gallons of it in 2004. Brazil has also made a major investment in sugarcane-based ethanol, producing 4 billion gallons of it in 2004. Brazil now produces 37% of the global ethanol supply and has exported 112 million gallons of ethanol to the U.S. market. Other South American countries, like oil-rich Venezuela and Colombia, are promoting the production of ethanol, with a surplus possibly going to energy-hungry California. Already there are fears in the American Farm Belt that duty-free imports, coming in as a result of the Caribbean Basin Initiative, a loophole preserved in the recently enacted Central America Free Trade Agreement, could hurt the heavily subsidized American ethanol industry. Coca-Cola, the soft drink giant, is facing a growing and powerful global campaign critical of its labor and environmental practices. Student activists in the United States and Europe are pressing schools and colleges to ban the sale of Coke on campus. Activists had a big win in mid-December when New York University, the largest private university in the country, kicked Coke off campus. At the same time, hundreds of poor villagers protested outside a Coke bottling plant in the northern state of Rajasthan, India. They wanted the plant to be shut down, blaming Coke for severe water shortages caused by groundwater depletion and soil pollution. In southern India, anti-Coke activists have shut down a major bottling plant for over a year and a half, according to the One World Net website. In Colombia, labor activists blame Coke for the murder and torture of union organizers. American labor advocates are pressing Coke for an independent probe into violence against union leaders. Veteran labor organizer Ray Rogers, head of the campaign to stop Killer Coke, claims Coca-Cola and its affiliates are rife with immorality, corruption, and complicity with murder. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The September 11th attacks were a wake-up call to the nation about the deep flaws in U.S. intelligence agencies that failed to detect and prevent the worst attack on the American mainland since the War of 1812. Although President Bush was thwarted in his attempt to block the formation of the 9/11 Commission to examine those failures, many critics believe that in the end, the commission itself was unsuccessful in completing that important task. The movie Syriana, directed by Steven Gagan, presents a compelling story that links the issues of Middle East oil, corruption, politics, and terrorism. The film was based in part on the book See No Evil, the true story of a ground soldier in the CIA's war on terrorism, written by Robert Baer, a retired 21-year veteran of the CIA. During his work as a field agent in the Middle East and South Asia from 1976 to 1997, Baer witnessed Washington's inability to confront the rise of terrorist networks that culminated in the 9/11 attacks. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Baer, who explains why he believes Washington politics, corruption, and corporate influence have hurt America's fight against terrorism.
In 1986, when the main counterterrorism position came open in Beirut, I never thought I'd get it. I thought that would be a primo job. And I applied to it in the Near East Division, which was administered Beirut at the time. I wasn't getting along with the chief. But they took me because I was the only person. So here we have a country that almost brought down the Reagan administration. If you look at Iran-Contra, a bunch of Americans had disappeared. We were under attack. All these ideas, even bin Laden, his original idea to attack the West occurred in Beirut. We had one person. And we had one person volunteering for this position. The CIA had become a horrible bureaucracy. You couldn't get things done for most people.
If you were to specify which of the wrong turns the CIA took in confronting terrorist organizations, what would top that list?
Oh, it'd be Saudi Arabia, no question at all. Because back then, people in the Middle East were aware that things were not going well in Saudi Arabia. And it wasn't just bin Laden. The country was becoming very anti-American. We, the world, was more dependent upon Saudi oil, 26% of the world's reserves, the only swing producer. And then I got into the computers, the Directorate of Intelligence, the Directorate of Operations. I essentially saw every piece of intelligence we had on Saudi Arabia, on bin Laden, and there was none. There was some press reporting, but our station in Saudi Arabia was not spying on the Saudis, and that's what the CIA is paid to do. We didn't know what was going on inside the mosques. In some countries, we have what are called mosque watchers. They simply go in and listen to what people are preaching or what they're saying or recruiting. And so when we found out there were 15 Saudis on those planes on September 11th, it came as a surprise to everybody. But it wasn't because it was that well hidden. It was because we weren't looking. We had the safe assumption that the Saudis were on our side. They'd always be there pumping our oil, protecting our security in the Middle East, and going along with our politics. It was willful blindness.
Robert Baer, you write about politics, Washington politics derailing the CIA's work, as well as U.S. corporate interests. When you talk about U.S. corporate interests, tell us what you mean.
Well, for instance, in 1999, you had British Petroleum was in a fight with a Russian company. So what they did is they tasked all these ex-KGB guys to write a bad report about this Russian company. They sent it to the White House, which rewrote the report, sent it to the CIA, put it on CIA letterhead or, you know, on a disseminated intelligence, and sent it to the State Department to get the loan killed to this Russian company. Here's an evidence of an oil company providing intelligence directly to the U.S. intelligence establishment and changing our policy in this case. Afghanistan, when I was in the CIA, the only intelligence coming out of Afghanistan in the 90s was from UNICAL, which had people on the ground. They were working with the Taliban. We had nobody in Afghanistan. And, you know, they now we're going out and we're outsourcing intelligence as we speak today. You know, I could name the companies, SAIC, Northrop. You know, all these companies are going out and they're hiring ex-CIA people to provide intelligence, which we've just basically turned intelligence over to corporations.
Robert Baer, I wanted to get your view on the movie Syriana, upon which, you know, quite prominently, the producer and director of the movie says it's based on, in large part, your book.
Well, first of all, I didn't think there was going to be a movie. And so when the studio approached me and they said, hey, do you want to work on a movie with us based on your book? I said, fine. And when he came down, I took a trip with the director slash screenwriter, the same guy who did Traffic. He went on a trip with me, and he started listening to people in Beirut, arms dealers in Nice, oil traders in London, heads of corporations, terrorists. We met a lot of terrorists in Syria and Lebanon. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this trip, the whole thing came together, you know, based on the Traffic template. The guy wrote Traffic. And he started to see these independent narratives coming together, storylines, if you like, and how all these people were swept up in this very complex world that didn't know what the role, you know, of other people were playing. They didn't know the motivations. I like the movie because it sucks people into stories they don't really understand. But if you're smart, you're quick, you understand. Well, you're not supposed to really understand because a lot of the action takes place off screen. But you do get the emotional, you know, wallop at the end. And that's why I like the movie, the technique. And it is. Those voices are authentic. You know, individual stories of these people are true in the movie. So you have this very documentary feel. And the thing you walk away from the movie is it's the system that's broken. There's nobody in that movie you can point out is totally evil, manipulating the world from behind the scenes to our detriment. Everybody's part of it. George Clooney sells out at the beginning by going ahead and trying to, you know, going after and to assassinate this Arab leader. Everybody, the Jeffrey Wright, the lawyer, and so on. And that's why, you know, you walk out of this movie with this sense of dread of, oh, my God, how do we fix this?
Well, you're the guy we can turn to for some ideas on how we fix it, right?
No, I said I can pose the problem, not fix it. But, I mean, the way to fix it is obviously we have to get off our dependency on cheap oil.
Right.
Now, there's hundreds of ways that you can approach this problem. They should all be approached at once. You know, anything from raising gradually the tax on gasoline to using solar energy, to using, you know, drilling in oil fields that previously couldn't be drilled. You know, just getting people or, you know, cars or using hydrogen energy. It just, we just need to put hundreds of billions of dollars rather into a war in the Middle East, put it into technology.
That was Robert Baer, author of the book See No Evil, the true story of a ground soldier in the CIA's war on terrorism, published by Three Rivers Press. Director Stephen Gagan based his movie Syriana on Baer's book. The destruction wrought by Hurricane Katrina last fall unmasks the desperate plight of large numbers of poor people living in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast region. Seeing the disaster firsthand, the nation's media briefly focused attention on this hidden aspect of American life, where poverty is endemic in every major city in the country. Stagnating wages, higher housing, health care, and education costs, combined with the weakened labor movement and the export of manufacturing jobs overseas, has resulted in a growing gap between the rich and poor in America. While CEOs of big corporations increase their incomes exponentially, those in the middle and at the bottom are losing ground. A book examining these disturbing trends titled Economic Apartheid in America, A Primer on Economic Inequality and Insecurity, analyzes the policies that have contributed to this disparity and its impact. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Felice Yeskel, co-author of the recently revised and updated book first published in 2000. She discusses the causes of inequality and some prescriptions for change.
Here's the basic story. Profits are up, but wages and the incomes of average Americans are down. When you adjust for inflation, weekly wages now are still below where they were at the start of, quote-unquote, the economic recovery in November of 2001. However, productivity and the growth of the economic pie keeps growing. It's up by 13.5%. So I think that you can look at the median household income, and it's fallen. When you adjust for inflation, it's less now than it was in 1999. And if you take the wages for the average worker and you adjust for inflation, wages don't buy what they were even buying back when Nixon was president. How people cope with the fact that wages are flat or moving backwards are they work more hours, so the phenomena of multiple jobs is increasing. The number of incomes that it takes to support a family are increasing. It used to be one job could support a family. Now oftentimes two barely make ends meet. So people work longer hours, work more jobs. People go deeper into debt. Basically, the indebtedness of households after adjusting for inflation has risen 35.7% over the last just 4 years, which is just unbelievable. The level of debt as a percent of after-tax income is the highest ever measured in our nation's history. And personal savings is negative for the first time since World War II. So people's lives are tremendously more insecure.
If you had to put it in a nutshell, what are some of the major causes of income inequality taking from the marketplace as well as the policies set in Washington?
The level of economic inequality we have today, to a large extent, is the result of a variety of different policies. There was a power shift in this country. Power shifted from Main Street to Wall Street. Some of the institutions that represented working people and the power of working people, labor unions, certainly have been on the decline. Again, I don't think that was random. I think that there has been a deliberate campaign against the labor movement by the forces in whose interest it is to see working people lose power. I think that the government has, you know, defunded regulatory agencies, and it's much harder to organize in many countries like Canada to our north. It's simple to organize in your workplace. When you get a majority of people who sign cards saying they want to join a union, you have a union. Not so here in the United States. The hoops that we have to jump through are much harder. So there was a deliberate campaign to cast unions in a bad light. I think the way global trade rules have been written has been a major piece of the puzzle. Trade rules have been written to benefit corporate investors and owners, not to benefit workers, not to benefit communities, and not to protect our natural environment and resources. we could write trade rules quite differently rather than encouraging a race to the bottom where people are pit one nation against another, one state against another. We could write them in such a way that they offered a minimum wage floor for everyone, minimal, you know, or higher than minimal protections for the environment everywhere, and change the rules of competition. But again, it's not a democratic process, and those who stand to make the most profit are the ones who get to write the rules. Some of the government policies in terms of taxes and spending have also changed the name of the game.
Well, Felice, give us your take, your short take, on how you think people can become active trying to move our society in a more egalitarian direction.
Well, you know, I don't think there is a magic bullet. I think there are lots of different kinds of actions. I think the most important thing is that everyone do something. Economic apartheid in America devotes one-third of itself to concrete actions that people can take, whether that's, I think, starting with education and learning about what the situation is critical. And then I think that there's a zillion ways to take action from the local level to, you know, how you use your dollars in terms of shopping and investing, to where you buy your products, to public policy debates, minimum wage organizing and making it a living wage, getting active around tax policies. I think the thing that we need to remember is that every other time in our nation's history, when wealth was as concentrated into as few hands as it is today, that people organized into social movements and changed the rules that govern the economy. It didn't happen overnight. We're not going to fix it overnight. But I am utterly convinced, Scott, that if people start to take action, however small each individual action seems to take, it will add up. That is how movements start. And once it catches on, it can have a lot of power to changing the way things are.
That was Felice Yeskel, co-author, along with Chuck Collins, of Economic Apartheid in America, published by the New Press. Yeskel is the co-director of the group Class Action. Visit their website at www.classactionnet.org. Four months after Hurricane Katrina and subsequent flooding put 80% of New Orleans underwater, environmental testing shows that all those returning to the devastated parts of the city face major health risks from toxic contaminants that spread over the land and then became airborne. The Army Corps of Engineers is now planning to remove tons of sediment laced with cancer-causing chemicals from New Orleans' flooded neighborhoods. The Dallas Morning News reports that government test results show that contaminants in the sediment include toxic metals, industrial compounds, petroleum byproducts, and a banned insecticide. Wilma Subra, a Louisianan, has used her experience as a chemist to help a number of grassroots groups throughout the state. She is president of Subra Company, an environmental consulting firm she founded in 1981. In 1999, she won a MacArthur Genius Grant for her work. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who spent 2 weeks in New Orleans in November, spoke with Subra about how dangerous the contaminated soil and air are to human health and how the government and private groups differ in their response to it.
From the very beginning of the hurricanes that impacted the New Orleans area as well as the coast, the tidal surge actually transported onto the land huge quantities of sediment out of the water bodies, out of the lakes, out of the streams, out of the rivers, out of the estuaries, and layered it over the whole land wherever the floodwaters and storm surge contacted. This historical contaminated sediment in the water bodies has been a result of discharges from industrial facilities, municipal facilities, agricultural runoff for decades and decades and decades. So it's constantly building up in the bottom of these water bodies. Now it's layered as a layer on the land. And then as the water started to drain off or be pumped off, it became this sludgy material, some places 6 inches thick, some places 2 to 3 feet thick. And then over time, as the dewatering continued, the material started to dry out and be dispersed into the air by anyone who drove through the area, by the responders as they were going in there and trying to clear things. And it became airborne. looking at this sedimentary sludge that's coating everything and looking at what is in it, we're finding high levels of toxic heavy metals such as arsenic, a known cancer-causing agent. We're finding a lot of the other heavy metals, not at as high a level, but adding to the cumulative impact, we're finding barium, cadmium, chromium, lead. And then the other part is the huge quantity of bacteria, the E. coli, the coliforms from untreated sewage, the Staphylococcus aureus, which causes skin rashes and skin infection, and then a lot of mold and yeast-type organisms.
I know there's a difference of opinion among government agencies on the one hand and nonprofit organizations that work in the region and residents themselves about how dangerous the situation is.
The agencies feel that it's not severe enough, won't cause enough long-term harm to actually merit going in and spending the money to remove it. However, if you talk to the people who are going back in, you talk to the responders, and you talk to the people that are just living in the area near it with so much airborne, you find they're all having the acute impacts. The acute impacts are skin rashes, infections that don't respond to normal antibiotic treatment, respiratory problems, asthma attack, chronic bronchitis. And the bronchitis and the asthma attacks have gotten worse as the sedimentary sludge has become more airborne. The governing officials make the decision which areas can have people go back into. They do it based on data that the Environmental Protection Agency and the state agencies are providing to them. Recently, the Environmental Protection Agency has put out notices that the people should not come in contact with them and should wear protective gear such as Tyvek suits, gloves, respirators, goggles. We had to start in the very early days, within the first week after the hurricanes hit, with putting together what we call recovery kits, where we're providing the NGO community, Louisiana Environmental Action Network, working with Southern Mutual, devised these kits, and now Louisiana Environmental Action Network is actually distributing these kits to community people who are going back. The Environmental Protection Agency and the health agencies have approved the kits, and now the Environmental Protection Agency is putting in their brochure that you should wear this kind of equipment. But they are not providing this kind of equipment. It's not total risk reduction, but it is risk reduction. It's providing the people some protection as they go back in and decide what they're going to do.
Some grassroots groups suspected that the government was saying it was worse than it was just to keep people from returning. These groups feared a plan to gentrify the whole area. But when I was in New Orleans, a report came out from the National Resources Defense Council, the NRDC, that it was actually worse than the government was saying.
I did the sampling of the sediment sludge for NRDC. One of their other scientists did the air monitoring. And we did the air monitoring after we did the sedimentary sludge and saw what the chemical contamination was in it. And we were trying to get some handle on the extent of this particulate matter, which causes huge respiratory impacts. The Environmental Protection Agency is just doing fixed locations. But when you actually go in the area and follow behind, like vehicles, and go in areas where there's a lot of work going on, and these areas are primarily the more upscale areas, that the concentrations of the particulate matter are huge. And so the issue was trying to notify the people that if you're in areas where you can actually see the dust and taste the dust and have it come in contact with your skin, this is an area you have to be really, really cautious about. And so NRDC was trying to put that in context with people on the ground. We have a lot of Hispanic workers that have been brought in by contractors. They wear no protective clothes. Most of them wear a T-shirt and shorts, no respirator, no gloves, and they're all coming in contact with this. We're in a very difficult situation because as we develop this data and try and get the cautions out to the people and try and provide the people with what they need to go back in the poor communities, the concept is that we're trying to keep them out. So it's very difficult to balance. We're not trying to keep them out. We're not trying to allow other people to go in and take their homes. But we want to keep them healthy.
That was Wilma Subra, an environmental chemist and winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant. For more information on the grassroots response to post-Katrina toxic contamination, contact the Louisiana Environmental Action Network at area code 225-928-1315 or visit their website at www.leanweb.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show Saturdays 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. Today, we leave you with two quotes. First, we must bring you these last words from our president.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
And, as reported in The Progressive magazine, the obituary for Theodore Roosevelt Heller, a past member of U.S. Army and National Guard, ended with the note, quote, "In lieu of flowers, please send acerbic letters to Republicans," end quote.